This episode of Continuing Mission is brought to you by the wonderful patrons of Trek FM, who support us through Patreon. If you love Star Trek discussion, visit patreon.com/TrekFM to find out how you can help and even become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trek.fm. And we thank everyone for their support.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome everyone to Continuing Mission, our look at the way fans are keeping Star Trek alive. I'm your host, Tony Robinson, and the primary focus of this show is on the fan series or independent productions that tell new stories set in the Star Trek universe. In this episode, I'm joined by Gary O'Brien, the director of the new Star Trek fan film, Chance Encounter. He's been an avid filmmaker since his early teens, during which he has developed considerable skills and talents in the art of film production. These talents have led to him working with various TV and film production companies, including doing some major work with the James Bond franchise on Die Another Day, and on Oliver Stone's epic, Alexander. On both of these productions, Gary was able to utilize his skills as a visual effects technician and a vision mixer. He's been credited by Empire magazine, no less, as the ultimate Trekker, after winning a competition to help promote the UK release of Star Trek Beyond. He's also contributed original artwork to the 2016 official Star Trek Ships of the Line calendar. All of these interests, passions and skills have led him to produce his latest venture, the Star Trek fan film, Chance Encounter. So let's get into the turbo lift and go and meet with Gary O'Brien. Hi Gary, welcome to Continuing Mission.
Hello Tony, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome, great to have you here. We're going to start off tonight, obviously, getting to know a bit about you and everything about Chance Encounter, your latest film venture. But we'll start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself and your involvement with the movie Chance Encounter, how that came to be.
Okay, great. How did it come to be? I've made a few short films in the past. Chance Encounter actually is, I think, the 10th or 11th that I've made over the last sort of same amount of years, really. And I work with a friend of mine, a good friend called Paul Late, and he and I have written and produced these films together for the last 10 years or so. And we were in the mood to do another one. And so we set about doing one. And I had an idea, a very loose idea of roughly what I wanted the film to feature. And that was that I was interested in the idea of pairing a kind of older man with a younger woman, and having those two, that dynamic kind of be central to the plot of the film, whatever this film was going to become. And that was all we had really to start with. It certainly wasn't a science fiction film particularly at that point. I just thought that was something unusual, that you didn't see that often in films. And then on the occasions when you do see it, it's normally got some sinister undertone. The man is normally a threat to her, or you just don't trust him, or something bad's going to happen. And I didn't want that to necessarily be the case either. And so from that start point, Paul and I started to just conceive of some script ideas. And Paul is more the writer than I on these things. And he came up with a couple of sort of story outlines and rough ideas. And eventually he got to one where he put a little science fiction element into the script that he, the outline that he came up with. And I liked that. And I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. And we sort of headed in the science fiction direction. And then after that, I kind of realized, well, actually, this could maybe work as a Star Trek story, because, I mean, I'm a huge Star Trek fan. This is the first Star Trek film I've made, but, you know, I'm a huge Trekkie. And so sort of organically, this sort of Star Trek vibe started appearing in this story idea. So I mentioned it to Paul. You know, did he think that was a good idea? Did he want to do a Star Trek thing, or was that a terrible idea? And he was up for it. He thought it seemed good. And so we said, well, why not? And so from that point on, we started crafting it into a Star Trek film rather than just any other kind of generic sci-fi or whatever. And yeah, that's how it came about.
So you didn't actually set off with the idea of creating a Star Trek movie. I mean, most people sort of have this dream of creating a Star Trek movie and then write a script or create a situation, you know, for their movie. But you kind of did it the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of unusual, I guess, when you think of it like that. Like I said, we enjoy making films, and they're always quite modest. You know, I think the most we've ever spent on a film is about $5,000 or $6,000, and that was sort of self-raised funds. Because like I said, we've been doing it for 10 years or so. My maths is so bad. I keep saying 10 or 11 years. It was, I think our earliest one was about 2005. So I guess that's 12 years, I guess. I don't know. But, yeah. And that was long before crowdsourcing or anything like that. So, you know, it was literally just sort of our own money originally, especially Paul. He was in a position to put a bit more in back at our early films 10 or so years ago. So yeah, we just funded them, but we enjoyed making them. And so we kept doing them. You know, he liked writing and I liked directing and editing and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, it just became time for us to, you know, satisfy our thirst to make another. And then, yeah, like I say, the Star Trek element kind of came after that, you know, as part of the process.
So it was the best of both worlds.
Well, very clever. Yes, it was indeed.
Yeah, I kind of slipped that one in. I didn't think anyone would actually notice that phrase. But how long have you been a Star Trek fan?
A long time. As a long time for me, as long as I can recall, really. I guess from being about 10 years old. I don't remember exactly first sort of seeing it on the TV particularly, but I can remember drawing a no doubt very bad drawing of the Enterprise on a whiteboard at school in what was our very high-tech computer lab that they had there at the school. And remembering what school that was, I know that I would have been about 10 at the time. So that's kind of my earliest memory of actually, you know, caring or being interested in Star Trek. I may well have seen it at a younger age and it hadn't sort of done anything. But yeah, definitely at about 10 years old. So that's a while ago. Not too long, but a little while ago.
I should mention to the listeners that you're actually speaking from your home in Oxfordshire, in England. I only mention that because it seems that the majority of people who do come on the show tend to be based in the United States. So it's refreshing to hear a different accent.
Yes, indeed. Yes, you're quite right. I am in Oxfordshire at the moment, which isn't too far from London, because frankly, compared to the States, nothing in England is too far from London, really. We're such a small nation. But yes, that's right. We shot it and made it all, and the whole thing was done locally to me, which is in Oxfordshire, or Oxfordshire, as some people might like to
yeah,
say it.
Well, okay. I was going to say it could be Leicestershire or Worcestershire.
Yes. Buckingham Palace.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. All right. When it comes to filmmaking, did you have any formal training in the filmmaking art? Did you go to a filmmaking school, or did you just discover it as you came as you went along?
Sort of the latter, really. I haven't had any formal training really at all. No, I think I'm of the age. I'm in my mid thirties. I only hesitate because I can't actually quite remember if I'm 34 or 35. I think I'm 34 still, but that's how old I am. So that means that I was kind of the age where, when I was a kid and I was 10, 11, 12, 13, VHS was still very much king, of sort of home movies. There was no digital stuff really, not for just a kid anyway, back then in the sort of mid 90s. But I was always interested in making films, and just was fortunate enough to be able to have free rein on my dad's VHS camcorder, and just got, you know, really enjoyed it. I mean, these films were, they didn't really have any story, which is something that we've corrected in later years. But when you're 12 or 13, you know, and you've got a camera, you really just want to just play with it and experiment with editing stuff together. You know, the joy of just sort of coherently editing the somebody walk round a corner and through a door and take a seat. To edit that with VHS, as anybody who's ever done it will know, is no easy task. And so back in the early days of making films just for the fun of it, it really was quite an undertaking. I mean, something that could be done on a computer now so easily was a lot of, you know, just difficult just to get one cut to work correctly on VHS was a real chore. And of course, every time you maybe screwed it up a little bit, you were wearing out that part of the tape that you were dubbing to. And so every time you tried to make a cut, if you didn't get it right and you went back and tried to do it again, you were physically wearing out that piece of tape. So yes, an interesting process, editing on VHS. But it was enough to get me interested in it, and it held my interest. And then all through sort of childhood and into my teens, I stuck with it. And, you know, as time went on, I got better and better equipment as it became available. And Saturday jobs could, you know, help me afford to buy some of this stuff. So when Mini DV came on the scene, that was a huge step forward for somebody in my position. And yeah, and, you know, so just have made films always, and then just as time has gone on, we've spent more and more time and energy and effort making them and writing them as well, because, you know, as everybody knows, hopefully the key to a good film is the story, and everything follows from that. And yeah, and that's certainly where we're at now. We hope, at least, that we're able to tell good stories, and the technical stuff is all kind of we did that first when I was a kid. And now we're at the story stage, hopefully. So,
well, we'll come back to the main subject matter, which is your movie Chance Encounter, in a little while, because in itself it's pretty comprehensive. But before we get there, how many actual film projects have you worked on and completed? I mean, it's all part of your training, quote unquote, to get where you are today. But how many actual film projects did you actually complete?
I mean, you could, I mean, I said at the start here that we've probably done, at least me and my partner with Chance Encounter, we've done 10 or 11 films. And I consider those ones to be sort of proper film projects, which are available for people to watch online and all that kind of thing. And yet, you know, if you start at 10 or 12 years old making films, there's be lots of people, I'm sure, in a similar position to me that have just got thousands of little tiny vignettes and sketches and music videos and comedy things and just experiments. And so I couldn't guess, really. It would kind of depend on how precise you want to be with your definition of what is a film project. But anything from conservatively 10 or 11 all the way to hundreds or thousands, probably. It's just, you know, when you're into that kind of thing, you're just constantly messing around and editing something. And you know, some of them are lost now. They probably maybe still exist on a damaged VHS tape in a loft somewhere. And yeah, so it's hard to say, but you know, people, I think, who are like me, because I mean, lots of people are, and you look around at people who are, you know, younger than me. It's kind of the landscape now. I mean, everybody, most teenagers now will have a high def video camera with them at all times and can probably edit on that same, you know, phone. So I think people will realize that, you know, it's something that if you're into making films, then you'll just keep making stuff constantly, all kinds of weird projects and dumb ideas. And
have you published any of your previous work on YouTube or Vimeo or anything like that?
Yeah, it's, I mean, a small selection of it is up on YouTube. I think all the films that Paul and I have done together are up there. You know, and, you know, this is the power of Star Trek, in that, you know, none of our other films over the last number of years have had anything like the amount of views that Chance Encounter has already had. Chance Encounter went up on the 1st of February this year. It's had about 20,000 views so far, which, you know, it is so streets ahead of any of our previous things that we've put on YouTube. And that's because, you know, obviously people are interested in Star Trek, and there's this whole Star Trek fan film genre out there that people are interested in. And so that was, I mean, we were kind of aware of that going into this, that, you know, oh, maybe this one will get a bit more of a viewership because it's Star Trek. But we did it organically. As I said, it just kind of came about. As I said, this story could be Star Trek. But yeah, other films are up on YouTube. I've even got some of the ones that I did when I was about 10 or 11 years old. I've put them on an obscure hidden YouTube channel because I don't really want anybody to see them. But I thought it's probably the best way to back them up safely is to stick them on YouTube servers. They'll be safer there than in my possession.
Well, I'm sure it's important to keep an archive of your work, you know.
Yes.
Not to make a comparison between Chance Encounter and any other Star Trek fan movie that's out there, but were you surprised at the number of Star Trek fan movies being made?
I was, actually. I mean, I am, as I say, a big Star Trek fan, and as you alluded to in your intro there, I've almost sort of got proof to back it up in that I'm the ultimate Trekkie, according to James Dyer of Empire magazine. So my credentials are there, but I will admit I wasn't particularly knowledgeable of the fan film subgenre. I mean, I was aware there were fan films. I think probably I was more aware of Star Wars ones, to be honest, because I have a few friends that had shown me those, you know, over the years. They said, hey, you know, check this out, it's quite well done or whatever. And then I was aware of Star Trek Continues. And I had seen Prelude to Axanar, and I thought both were very good and was surprised. I remember sending a link of, I think it was Star Trek Continues, to one of my friends who'd always shown me these Star Wars ones. And he was like, what is this? Is this like a fan thing? Because, you know, we weren't following it closely. And last we checked, fan films, you know, weren't at that standard by any stretch of the imagination. And so, yeah, once we decided to do our film and, you know, it kind of forced me to look into fan films, Star Trek ones specifically, a bit more. And yeah, I've subsequently realized just how much of a broad sort of little club the fan films are. It is quite staggering just how many there are and how long they've been going, you know, from way back in the 60s. As far as I can tell, people have been making fan films one way or another, and it seems that, you know, it's not slowing down by any means, you know.
No, it certainly isn't. What surprised you most about some of the productions was it? I think you did mention Star Trek Continues, you know, incredibly high quality, but were you struck by, you know, the quality of any other productions as well, or?
I thought the Prelude to Axanar thing was really well done. At the time when that came out, you know, I just found it, I didn't know anything about all the controversies, or even if there were controversies when that first came out, I actually think that there weren't, were there? I think it just came out and everybody liked it broadly, and then people maybe started to change their minds on it. Well, I don't really have an opinion on all that, to be honest, but I did think that Prelude to Axanar was very well done. And then, because I guess probably because that and Star Trek Continues, from what I could see, were the sort of the newest entrance to the fan film, you know, collection. And I think just typically, you know, the curve always just sort of goes up at 45 degrees. You know, given enough time, the quality will increase as people pool their resources, and also filmmaking, at least, you know, the technology gets cheaper and better. You know, this crazy kind of law of, you know, the cameras come down in price and get better. So perhaps just by virtue of the fact that they were the sort of newest ones on the block, they were production-wise, you know, better perhaps than ones that had gone before, even 5 or 10 years prior. They were much better. But yeah, I mean, I'd say, you know, in fairness, the quality of the stuff, it varies a lot, just as much as the ideas do. You know, it's like any other aspect of fandom, I suppose. You know, you can go to a convention and you'll see somebody with, you know, some amazingly intricate, brilliantly crafted outfit cosplaying next to somebody who's, you know, just got like a t-shirt on with a hand-drawn emblem on the chest. And it doesn't really matter, you know, as long as you're having fun making what you're making and doing it to the level that, you know, you can do it to, then that's all good. And so I think, yeah, you know, you see that manifests very much in the fan films, because the quality and the way people approach doing them is so varied. It's really quite interesting, just, you know, from a kind of observer's point of view of, you know, how rich the landscape is in quality.
Mm-hmm. Coming around to your movie Chance Encounter, because I'm sure that's what everybody really wants to hear about. in my opinion, Chance Encounter differs from a lot of other fan films insofar as you actually shot it on location and not on a stage. There's very little set pieces, you know, with a set background or on a set. There may be some green screen that you've utilized, but the majority of it is literally on location. And what brought it about that you decided to shoot outdoors?
Well, I suppose technical concerns, really. I mean, first of all, as I mentioned earlier, this idea that we'd had way back about a man and a woman together, we'd always envisioned that being, even though we didn't really know what this idea necessarily was going to become, part of the man and the woman dynamic was that they were going to be somewhere interesting or kind of romantic or serene or something. So, you know, very early on that they were going to be, when it, you know, was a contemporary film, they were going to be sat on some sort of rooftop of a city building at night with the traffic sound below them and just looking out at all the twinkling lights in the buildings. You know, we had that idea, or then it was going to be some very serene kind of a glade or wooded area or something. That had always been sort of inherent in the idea from the start. Then, as it became a Star Trek thing, we retained that kind of desire. It fit what we were trying to tell in our story. And of course, it's cheaper to do it outside. You don't have to build anything. And if you can find somewhere that looks generic and doesn't have obvious buildings or anything in the background, then it can be, you know, an alien planet, you know, or Bronson Canyon or wherever. So part of it was that we wanted to just keep it affordable and achievable. Secondly, we did build two sets, and one of them is a shuttle pod and one of them is a turbo lift. And that was the desire because I, even though I sort of do quite a lot of green screen work for my job, you know, variously, for the sort of kit we were going to have and the resources that we had available, including the time we knew we would have with the actors to shoot it in, I wasn't convinced that we would be able to do what I would consider a good enough job if we green screen stuff. So the idea of green screening people into the bridge or the corridors or the transporter room was out. I wanted to do it with real sets or sort of not at all, really. And so that led us to figuring out what were the simplest, smallest sets that we could build and still tell our story in. And that got us to a shuttle pod. We might remember them from the Next Gen, because it's a Next Gen era film, I think we said. And so their smallest little two-seater shuttle pod, we went for that because we thought, well, that's about as small a set as you can really get away with. And so, yeah, some of the film is in the shuttle pod. It, you know, we cut back and forth to there. And like I said, also a sort of, we built a partial turbo lift set as well for another scene. But you're right, the rest of it, it does take place outside in the glorious sunshine and nature. So, yeah, which, as you say, perhaps is a little unusual because I think a lot of fan films, they often have a few sets, you know, primarily the bridge set normally. And so it makes sense for them to utilize that resource as much as possible and film as much as they can on the sets. But again, you know, as you said previously, we were kind of the other way around for some reason compared to other fan films. So, yeah.
One of the things I noticed about the film is the lighting. It's spot on. It looks so natural. And you obviously have experience in that, but you really did a good job there.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's very kind of you to say. Yeah, we did our best with it. It's, you know, I'd like to take full credit, but it's probably just as much a fluke and good fortune as it is skill. You know, we did our best. We've got some, you know, some sort of prosumer kit that we were using. It was nothing super fancy, but it wasn't sort of tabletop desk lamps either, you know, and yeah, you know, that's one good thing about, you know, shooting outside. I mean, there's pros and cons to that, of course. You know, one of the pros is you don't have to build any sets, and you can just get some nature can really do you a good favor if you get nice weather and you're able to control it. And if you're shooting in the summer, as we were, when the days are quite long, then if all goes well, You can get quite, you know, good favorable results. I mean, nothing looks nicer than, you know, a really nice bit of nature, you know, in the sunlight. It, you know, it does you so many favors if it's going well for you. Of course, the downside of shooting on a location, as we all know, is that, all the opposite of that is you've got potentially a lot less control over everything. The lighting, you know, if the weather's really changeable, then it could be a nightmare to keep the shots consistent looking, and actually creates more work. You tend to work slower. You've got problems like insects. I mean, we had a lot of insects causing trouble all the time. I mean, I'd done a recce and kind of knew there was an insect element to the location. We all had repellent ready, but, you know, just all these factors that can come into play, especially audio. You know, that they shoot on sound stages for a reason, you know, and they're sort of very obsessed with keeping every bit of sound down to an absolute minimum. And then, of course, when you're outside, you've got no control over aeroplanes or combine harvesters or, you know, just crazy bird song, which is just insanely over the top and just ruining it, all the dialogue. So, yeah, you know, you've got the pros and cons to it. But, I mean, another thing about a location shoot is finding somewhere that's actually going to work for you, you know, that's actually fits the criterion that the script calls for. And even if you find such a place, you've then got to seek permission to use it, make sure that, you know, you're allowed to be there and that you can do whatever you need to do whilst you're there, have cables everywhere, people, cars parked with stuff in, props and stuff, but going back and forward. And not only that, but your location needs to be somewhere that's in a good location for you. You could find a great location and have permission, but if it's like, you know, 50-mile drive from where you're based and you've got to get all your kit and all your crew and actors and cast all the way there every day and back, half your day's gone before you even do anything. So, yeah, you've got your pros and cons to using a location, but fortunately, the lighting helped us. We had hopefully good looking shots, and also the location was very close to where I live, so we were able to tick off some of those downsides, and that's why it's you know, got quite a bit of location work in the film.
It's quite impressive, and it's not an alien planet, or it is an alien planet in the sense that it's possibly not Earth, but it's quite a lush surrounding, and it was right for the part, or right for the setting. And the sound was great too, I have to say. There were no echoes, there were no struggling to hear what people were saying. It's an incredibly professional production, I have to say that.
Great, well, thank you.
Can I just ask, why did you set the story in the Next Generation universe? You know, and not in, say, Kirk's time, or...
I'm not entirely sure. I think it was, again, just probably a handful of sort of small reasons that led us to just say, well, why not? I think, firstly, Next Gen era is probably my favourite era. I mean, I love it all, but that's probably my favourite. I happened to own a Novos Next Gen tunic, which was a good quality one. So I was like, well, that's a good quality costume there. It seems a shame to make a film and not be able to use that. It seems that a lot of the fan films out there do go for the original series era as well. So that seems like well-trodden territory. And also, which is interesting, I don't know why people tend to go for the original series so much. Because I've wondered in the past if it's because maybe one reason is that there's the impression that if they're going to build sets, that Next Gen era sets are maybe more difficult to construct. But I'm not necessarily sure that's true. I was looking at, you know, the shuttle pod that we built and comparing it to the shuttle Galileo in the original series. And I think you'd probably put just as much effort into building both, but I think the Next Gen one would probably look so much better when finished, even if you did a completely accurate job. I just think the Next Gen sets have a better feel to them, you know?
Possibly it's the nostalgia factor with TOS. There's certain aspects of that show that strike chords with people that the latter Star Trek productions don't seem to have achieved.
Yeah, you could well be right. I suppose ultimately it's down to whoever's making the fan film to pick it, and it, you know, it's probably indicative of their favourite Star Trek series, the era that they set their film in. Because as I said, Next Gen probably does boil down. If forced to pick, then I'd probably say Next Gen is my favourite. But of course, Next Gen era, which is what we say we are, isn't necessarily Star Trek The Next Generation. You know, it could be, you know, up till Voyager, it's all sort of technically Next Gen era, I guess. But we're using the Next Gen era uniforms.
Yeah.
So that kind of narrows it down. And we did give a star date in the film, which means ours is set in sort of the middle of season 5 of TNG. Not that we're anything to do with TNG, of course, but that's where roughly in the timeline we decided to put it.
It firmly establishes in people's minds exactly where you are. And they get it right from the get-go. So,
yeah, and that's actually another interesting point about fan films more broadly, which, you know, like I said earlier, having come to just make my own film and then realize that there's this huge community of fan films that exists, it seems to me that a lot of the fan films, because the great thing surely about making a Star Trek film is that the universe is so broad and exists that you can literally just slot your own little story in, which is what we wanted to do. And you can just kind of pick, you know, is it original series, Enterprise, Next Gen? And you can just sort of slot your little story into that whole context, which everybody is already fully up to speed on. And it kind of, it's interesting to me because when we were thinking about doing a Star Trek film, I thought, well, all that world building has sort of already been done. And so I'm kind of impressed and also sort of a little bit scratching my head about the amount of fan films that want to go in areas that the TV series never did go to. Big prequels or explaining how the Federation starts or explaining, you know, Romulan Wars or explaining what happened after post-Nemesis and all this kind of thing, which is great. You know, that's obviously what interests the people that make those films and is, you know, good for them. That's really cool. But for me, I was just thinking, well, you know, we've got such limited time and resources. Let's, you know, let's not try and reinvent the wheel. Let's just plug right into what everybody knows. And as you say, they're bam, they're up to speed. You show them that uniform, that comm badge on, and they're like, oh, bam, yeah, got it. And that seemed to me to be a great, you know, a great time saving, a great asset and a real advantage of doing, you know, a riff on something that somebody else has thought up, you know, Star Trek, it's already a thing. So just slot into it seemed to be our idea. And also, you know, kind of another thing in a similar vein, another thought is that, you know, despite all the wonderful amounts of episodes that there are and all the different genres that Star Trek has sort of dabbled in, the fan favourites always, you know, whenever you see one of these listicles about what's the best Star Trek episodes, invariably it's City on the Edge of Forever, The Inner Light, The Visitor, things like that. You know, really kind of low-key low-key episodes that really are quite small personal stories. I mean, all three of those. I mean, City on the Edge of Forever is obviously just set in Manhattan in a basement kind of, and The Inner Light is set in a little village in a garden on the steps with a penny whistle, and The Visitors in a conventional looking house. So again, for me, as somebody, you know, we're very much aware of the difficulties of making a film. The fact that you know, the most popular episodes are the sort of simplest to recreate. You know, we don't need fleets of robots or all these crazy things going on. It's like, well, the most popular episodes are ones where it's two people sat in a garden talking. So great, that seems quite achievable compared to trying to remake, you know, the best of both worlds or something. You know,
The look and feel of the film gives off the impression that you had quite a crew operating behind you. Did you have a big crew on location with you?
No, not really. So I'm very glad that we created the impression that perhaps we did, because that's quite a compliment, so thank you. No, we were quite lean. I think on the location days that we've been speaking about, sort of out in the sort of glorious sunshine, we had a few more people. But I don't think there were ever more than five of us all together. And, you know, mostly just sort of volunteers, you know, mates that are, you know, helping out on the on the weekend, you know, holding something or ran into the car to grab something. We did have one of my friends is a professional sound recordist, and we did have him come along on the location days, or one of them rather, sort of the main day that we were on location. He was free and was able to come along, but otherwise we had to just kind of muddle through, doing the best we could. And, you know, and I guess, you know, as we said, you know, I've been doing it for a while, even if, you know, so even if not fully resourced with a crew, hopefully, you know, the years and years of practice have whittled it down to experience and kind of knowing, you know, kind of what to do and to get good enough results for the resources we have available, you know?
Yeah, well, it certainly shows. Your actors, where did they come from? They give a great performance. Are they from a drama school or are they friends or where do they come from?
Yeah, great. Thank you. I mean, we're really pleased, both Paul and I, you know, my partner in crime in all this, we're both really pleased with the performances. You know, they are all great actors, I think. And, you know, we've been talking about the sort of, you know, more techie parts of the sets and stuff, costumes, but obviously it doesn't really mean much if the performances are weak. And so, yeah, we're really thrilled with the performances we got from all of our actors. I think we had 5 in all, or it might have even been 6 actually. But we just, you know, experience from our previous films has shown us that you need proper actors. I mean, some of the early ones we've had maybe a mate standing in for a small background part. But on this film, everybody was properly cast through professional casting agencies. They're all professional actors. And frankly, I think if you've raised other people's money through a crowdfunding thing as we did on Kickstarter, I think for me at least, and our experience shows that, A, you need proper actors anyway, but B, it's kind of, I think it'd be a bit reckless to just chuck your mates in it because they want to, you know, be in the Star Trek film. That wasn't our attitude on this. I am the sort of the hardcore Trekkie of the group, but I'm also the sort of detached filmmaker, you know, who wasn't even originally going to be making a Star Trek film. And I think hopefully that discipline, which, you know, went through the whole production, but certainly on the casting, was there of, you know, we're making a film first, and that means we can't just, you know, let mates who want to dress up get involved, really. And we kept that ethic through, I think, the whole process, but certainly with the casting, yeah, we hunted them all out, put ads out. Some of them we kind of headhunted. I was just looking for, you know, sort of, we knew this film was happening, but we hadn't raised the money fully yet, and I wanted to just get going and, you know, work on the film. And so I started looking through thousands of headshots and looking at showreels of people just to see if anybody caught my eye, in the hopes that we could speed the process up on the assumption that we would get funded, which thankfully we did. And so those we approached directly, but the most of the other actors we just put an ad out explaining. We didn't say in the ad description it was a Star Trek thing because we weren't sure if that would be a good thing to do or not. So we erred on the side of caution and didn't say Star Trek fan film in case it, you know, put some people off or whatever, or just attracted, you know, crazy fans. So yeah, they were all professional actors and we're really pleased with all the performances. I think they did a really good job, actually.
Yeah, it really makes the film stand out. You created a crew, though. You've got some crew members on the shuttlecraft. You've got a captain on the turbo lift. Can you envisage further stories for these people?
I'm not sure, really. I guess all these characters were conceived purely to fit the story that we wanted to do. I guess if we were planning on doing a long running series, then we might have thought, you know, planned, oh, well, what would be good, who would be good to. Two different character types that will keep butting heads or, you know, whatever it might be. Whereas we just created these characters specifically for this story. I'd like to think that hopefully we did a good enough job that if we did want to revisit these characters, that, you know, they're not just like one trick ponies that only fit into this one film. But good as the performances are, I think if we were to do another one, whilst I'd happily work with everybody on the film again, if we could, I'm not necessarily sure that we're particularly wedded to any of the characters in this film enough to want to see their continuing adventures. I think anything else we did would be, you know, a whole fresh thing. Although, like I said, possibly reusing some of the actors because we think they were, you know, did such good jobs, but they would be in different roles, I imagine.
Well, I can see a story emerging from Chance Encounter, and that's agents from the Guardian of Forever are seeking throughout the universe to find a bit of their rock that this guy managed to steal.
Yes, it's funny, actually. I wonder, I hadn't thought of that. And perhaps it was even you. I don't know. Somebody a long time ago when the film first came out emailed me. I should dig it out and find out who it was with that same suggestion, essentially, that the rock was part of the Guardian. Perhaps it's quite obvious in retrospect. You know, that's a perfectly good theory, which I quite like. It wasn't our idea. We didn't think of that, but it's a good idea. Maybe we should claim that we did think of it. But yes, that could well be the explanation in the film. I've certainly got no objection to that maybe being what it's all about. But yeah, it's not my idea, unfortunately.
All right. Breaking the temporal prime directive. So in terms of Star Trek film, you don't particularly have any future ambitions to go to pursue a line down that road.
Not really with these characters, but I definitely feel like I'd like to do another Star Trek film, definitely. But it wouldn't be, like I say, a sort of direct sequel or using any of these characters. I don't really envision that. But yeah, as I said, Paul and I, we just every year or so we get the buzz and we want to make a film. And I think that will happen again. And I suspect that, you know, especially, I mean, I shouldn't underestimate just how flattering it is to get so many views and really overwhelmingly positive comments from people. You know, it really is very flattering. And it's certainly something that was new to us because, you know, as I said, our previous films, they were just, you know, anonymous little things withering on the vine buried somewhere deep into YouTube. And this one is the opposite of that, you know, certainly for us. And so, you know, the fact that it gets such an audience really makes you think, well, you know, as for that reason alone, perhaps Star Trek is appealing again. But also, ironically, a lot of people have said, oh, well, this film really captures the feel of Star Trek, which, you know, is very flattering. And I'm so pleased that people think that. Because, you know, surely that was our goal. But the irony is that it was conceived not for Star Trek, and it became Star Trek as we start, you know, as we moved along writing it. And so I kind of feel that we should do another one, at least one more, where it's conceived from the very first day as being a Star Trek film. Because I think that we could make another one even more Star Trek than this. And that's certainly not to say that this one isn't Star Trek, because you know, it very much is. But it, you know, I think there's scope there to do at least one more and really ramp up the Star Trekness on it so much that it would be, you know, just hopefully really good Star Trek.
Well, yeah. I hope so. Yeah. You mentioned reaction to the movie, and you had some feedback. How much feedback from fans have you had?
Yeah, loads. I mean, you know, I think last check there was probably like over 200 comments on YouTube in about a month and a half or so, which I guess compared to some videos isn't very much at all. But for us, certainly that's a huge response, you know, for anything we've done. And it's overwhelmingly positive. You know, people are so kind and generous, and it really makes us, you know, feel that we hopefully have done a good job. And if there are people that don't like it, they've just been very polite and not commented. So that which is very kind of them in a different way, if they're out there. But yes, you know, the feedback has been great. And I've been invited, I won't go into too much into it, but I've been invited to give a talk at a convention about the film and screen it as well, coming up later this year here in the UK. So yeah, so very cool. You know, it's great, you know, that people would, you know, want to be interested in our film is very flattering. And it certainly does make you think about, you know, well, if we did at least one more, you know, now we know what we know, we could probably do even better. I think there's one more in us somewhere, but it would depend, you know, we'd have to raise some money for it again. And, you know, and that's a whole other kettle of fish. And so, you know, we'll see. I mean, I'd like to do it, but I'm not sure. You know, there's no immediate plans to sort of start fundraising next week or anything, but we'll see.
Well, I think you'll find that there will be a demand from fans for another movie, and hopefully with the same crew, because it'd be nice to have some continuity built into Chance Encounter. Gary, it's an obvious question, but where can people see Chance Encounter?
Ah, yes, indeed. Well, it's on YouTube, of course, and the easiest way to find it is on our website. We created a website for this film, and it's called StarTrekShortFilm.com, and the film is right there. As soon as you land on the landing page, bam, you can watch the film embedded from YouTube. So, yes, StarTrekShortFilm.com, and, yeah, the film's right there. And then if you hunt around on the website, there's a behind the scenes little making of video as well, and some other bits and pieces that might be of interest if people are so inclined. And you could just, YouTube search Chance Encounter Star Trek, and hopefully it would come up as well.
Brilliant. And earlier on, I mentioned the lighting, and I forgot to ask one very important question. How many lights were there?
There were four lights.
Really? Four lights?
Yeah. Although I'm not so sure. Sometimes I thought I could see five.
Gary, I just wanted to say a big thank you for coming on to Continuing Mission and telling us all about Chance Encounter. It's a fantastic production, and it deserves a wider audience, and hopefully we'll get that wider audience from listeners to this show, and the number that you see on YouTube will rise accordingly.
Well, hopefully so. Thank you so much. It's been great to come on and talk with you about it. Thank you.
Okay, Gary. Thank you. And good luck in the future. If you've not yet seen Chance Encounter, then I recommend you find it on YouTube or go to Gary's dedicated website, StarTrekShortFilm.com, and be sure to send them a positive comment or two. It's always nice to hear from Star Trek fans, wherever they may be in the Alpha Quadrant and beyond. Now, in case you didn't know already, Continuing Mission is one show in a seemingly galaxy of shows on Trek FM. So here's what's been happening recently on our network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Star Trek II had just premiered 2 weeks earlier, right? So everyone's all excited and flush. Oh my God, that's more like it. They were all excited and flush about The Wrath of Khan being out. You know, it was the number one movie. It was incredible. People were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Just imagine seeing The Wrath of Khan for the first time, not knowing that it was always going to be the bar forever for every Star Trek movie after that.
Literary Treks.
I'm glad we reread this, because at the time I did read this, it was when the new movie was out. But now that we've had the three movies, as you just mentioned, and I've seen Star Trek 09 about 100 times, I'm very familiar with the movie, and not as much as with the comic now, because I've only read it maybe a couple of times.
Continuing Mission.
You know, we were pitching our idea, Don and I, to the folks at Starbase Studios, and I vowed to myself that I wasn't going to walk on the bridge and then go sit immediately in the chair and have a picture taken of myself. However, as soon as I got on the bridge, I sat in the chair and I took a picture of myself. So it was like a kid in a candy store.
The 602 Club.
I think the problem we have, and this is just in general of all the new canon books, these books are not going to succeed unless the author focuses on one or two characters and just focuses on building a character as much as they can. I felt this was more, just like you were saying, this is just more story of what's going on and not really about who these people are and why I should care about them.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So why not check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe? You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure and hit the subscribe button. That helps us out with ranking, and it makes it a whole lot easier for other listeners to find us on iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, well, we've still got you covered. You can find all our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 files from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm That's patreon.com/trekfm. You'll find our current goals and milestone contribution levels there, along with all the great perks we have for you. Or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. And don't forget the Babel Conference, which you can find on Facebook. The Babel Conference is a closed group, but if you ask to join, we'll let you right in, and you can join in all the hot topics we discuss on there. We also invite you to leave a rating or a review of Continuing Mission on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. I can always be found on the Babel Conference on Facebook and on Twitter. You can find me at Shamrock165. We'd like to acknowledge the rest of the Trek FM team, without which this or any other podcasts would not be possible. C. Brian Jones, our founder and publisher of Trek FM. Executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp. And Aaron Harvey, our art director. I'm Tony Robinson, and thank you for joining with us today on Continuing Mission, and we'll see you soon on the next mission.